Okay. Welcome back to Redefine Fitness. My name is Kelsey Wells, your host, and I have with me today one of my dear, dear friends, and this is someone who I have always, always wanted and hoped would oblige me in being a guest on this podcast. She is hands down one of the most empowering and inspiring women that I know. Oh my God, I'm actually already gonna cry. I have Elizabeth Smart here with me. So Elizabeth, thank you. Thank you for being here.
Kelsey, you're so kind. You are like, I follow you on Instagram when we don't see each other. Well, I've followed you forever anyway, but like, you're Wonder Woman. Like, what don't you do?
Oh, okay, well.
And you're kind and you say things that align with you and that are true to you, even if it's like against maybe what would be expected. And I so appreciate that. So it's such an honor to be with you today.
Gosh, thank you so much. For those of you who might not know, Elizabeth is a survivor. She is a warrior. And I put up a question box asking what you guys wanted us to discuss and specifically questions you had for Elizabeth. And the biggest one was for her to tell her story in her own words. And she has agreed to do that for us. So I'm going to let you take it away.
Okay. Well, I won't go crazy in depth because we'd be here for 9 months if I did.
However you feel is best.
But so I was born and raised in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I think most people, when they think of Salt Lake City or when they travel here or if they've grown up here, it's very easy to think, oh, this is such a safe city. Nothing bad ever happens. This is the place. And I certainly felt that way. Yeah. Like, I never felt threatened my entire childhood. You know, I lived in a lovely neighborhood. I grew up in a beautiful home. As far as I knew, nothing bad ever happened in my neighborhood. And certainly if it did, it was never aired for the public to see. Yeah. It was always behind closed doors. So I never knew about it. And I never felt threatened once. I never felt insecure, like with my safety, until one night. I was 14 years old. I was about to graduate from junior high. I went to bed, and the next thing I knew, I woke up to a man holding a knife at my neck. He'd broken into my home, gotten all the way upstairs to my bedroom, was holding a knife to my neck, telling me to get up and go with him. And you think of all like the safety that you're taught as a kid, like don't cross the street without looking both ways, like holding your mom's hand in a parking lot, don't take candy from people you don't know, earthquake drills, fire drills. But nobody, amidst all of this safety education, you know, nobody tells you like what you should do if someone breaks into your home in the middle of the night and holds a knife to your neck. I know that's a very specific example, but I didn't feel like anything that I knew could even apply to that situation. And so I didn't feel like I had an option. And so I did exactly as this man told me. He had me go up into the mountains behind my home.
Through your bedroom window?
He came in through the kitchen window. He'd broken in through our downstairs kitchen window. He came in through the middle of my home, up the staircase to my bedroom. My family was asleep, yeah. I mean, like my parents they weren't far away. Yeah. I mean, they were close. Like, yeah. I don't even know how it happened. Like, my parents would wake up on Christmas Eve, hear us trying to sneak down to the kitchen to see what Santa Claus brought. But they didn't wake up that night. I guess it's what you don't expect. Yeah. You're not prepared for. But so he'd broken in through the kitchen window, and he took me out through the kitchen back door. And then the actual distance that I was taken, I mean, it's not like a super far distance. It was just over 3 miles, like probably less than 3.5 miles, but just
on foot,
straight up back into the mountains behind my home. And where, you know, my house was at the edge of our neighborhood. So there was no more neighborhoods or anything. And when I got there, he told me that I was going to now be his wife and that I would come. Basically, I would come to view him taking me as him rescuing me, as a blessing, as something positive and miraculous happening in my life, and that I would come to love him. And then after that, he raped me, and then he chained me up. And I mean, it's a long story, but ultimately what it looked like or how he got away with what he did is if you step back and take a look at that piece in time, that moment in time, 9/11, it hadn't even been a year since 9/11 had happened. And I guess I can only speak for myself, but in my memory, everyone was very, very sensitive about religion because, at least in my memory, it seemed that 9/11 was like the Twin Towers coming down and like one of the, I don't even know the right words, but like one of the
hijackers,
like flames that sparked that, that whole thing was based around religion, was based around fanaticism and, or extremism or however you want to view it. And I think my captors recognized that and they realized that it scared people. They realized that they could control and manipulate people around them. So as they move forward in their life, they just became more and more extreme. So if anything in the future ever happened to look different, people wouldn't question it because they were already on this path of extremism. And when they'd been questioned in the past, they could say things like, well, this was part of my religion. This was part of my faith. Like, this is what I feel inspired or how I feel inspired to live my life. And I think that worked, honestly, really strongly in their favor because, I mean, they had adapted it so deeply into their lives that even it became a part of this whole facade that they played, even in private, not just in public. Wow. So
you say captors, so there were two, correct?
Yes. So there was the man who broke into my house, and he was actually married to my other captor, to a woman, and she was waiting at this hidden campsite that he took me to up into the mountains. And I mean, she was there as soon as we walked into camp. I mean, I remember begging and pleading with her tons of times to, you know, to protect me, to do something. And she never did. I mean, even after she'd left me on that first day and the man, Brian Mitchell, came back in to the tent where I was being kept at that moment in time, you know, I was so desperate to hold him off me that, I mean, like, I'm a late bloomer in lots of things. Yeah. I was a late bloomer in puberty, and I hadn't even started my period at that point in my life, even though I was 14. I hadn't started it yet. And I remember just, like begging and pleading with him, even to the point of telling him that I hadn't even started my period yet, that I was just a little girl. And I remember him yelling out of the tent to the woman, asking if it was still okay to rape me, even if I hadn't started my period yet. And she yelled back that it was okay. So, yes, I had two captors, and like, I view them both as equally guilty.
Absolutely.
They used religion or God to basically justify everything they did to me over the next 9 months. They had this whole plan that they were going to go out and kidnap 7 young girls. I just was the first one.
Oh my God.
And actually they had made other attempts before that had never been successful and they'd never been caught.
Wow.
And actually while I was held captive with them, they also made 2 more attempts to kidnap other girls, which, thank heavens, they were not successful with either. And then I, during my captivity, I was taken from Utah to Southern California.
How did you guys travel?
The Greyhound bus, which I just am going to make a little caveat for a second. Because I know now as people hear me say, oh, we rode on the bus. Yeah. Everyone's going to be like, why didn't you say something? Like, why didn't you do something? Yeah. The bus, like, there were other people there.
Yeah.
Yes. And I want to take a second just to explain this. Now, My entire life, you know, I had never felt threatened. I had never felt scared of someone else coming and hurting me. It didn't feel like it was a possibility. And then when it happened, and it happened to such an extreme degree, and I remember like that first day, like the whole, from the moment he kidnapped me, through like that first whole day before he raped me. Well, he kidnapped me, what, like, it's probably 2 or 3 in the morning, I'd guess. And when, by the time he probably raped me, it was probably like 8 o'clock, maybe. I mean, just guessing. I don't exactly know. But so I guess for those first few hours, like I just had complete faith that someone was going to rescue me. Yeah. That like, I mean, I was terrified, but I like.
Did you hear them searching?
I mean, at that point, no, yeah. No, not yet. But like, I just like, I was like nothing truly bad can happen to me. I mean, like I'm going to be rescued. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, this is just going to be a bad dream. Like, it's going to be okay. Like this time tomorrow, I'm going to be at home. Like everything's wow. going to be like, it'll be okay. But then of course I wasn't rescued. And over the next days and weeks, I mean, there was a very intense search effort put on where I did hear people yelling my name. And I remember helicopters flying so low overhead, like not just the trees were shaking, but the tent that I was being held in was shaking. And I mean, there were so many moments that I was like, this is it. Like, I'm going to be found. Like, this is it. But it didn't happen. And then you couple that with the fact that there are these two captors, everything that they ever threatened me with, they followed through with.
Wow.
Like there was no one ever there to protect me. Yeah. There was no one there ever to rescue me, to stop them from hurting me. So in my 14-year-old mind, my captors, I mean, it felt like they just became invincible.
Yeah.
And I mean, he used to bring back newspaper articles or missing flyers into this hidden camp where I was held at. And they were articles about me, articles about the search, articles about my family. And he'd show them to me and he'd be like, all of Salt Lake City is searching for you, but nobody will ever find you because I have you. So it just felt like he wow. had all of this power and all this control. And it just felt like I was completely helpless because nothing I could do up until that time did make a difference. Yeah. And he did threaten me. Like he threatened me with my family's life. He threatened me with my life. I mean, he really did feel like this sort of omnipotent, I don't know, monster.
Yeah.
And so when like they threatened me, like I felt like I had
yeah.
to do what they said. And I remember the morning that we left Utah, when we went to the bus depot, they had me, I mean, we were dressed differently, which was, I think, another way to keep people at arm's length. And it worked.
Because we're taught to not look or stare at people who are different.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we looked extreme. We yeah. looked extreme, and I think it scared people. And I mean, I had like a, you know, it's kind of funny, like during COVID and we all had to wear masks.
Oh my gosh.
I had so many people recognize me at the grocery store with a mask on. And I remember just thinking in the grocery store, how is it you can recognize me with like this stupid mask on? And you couldn't recognize me like when I was actually gone and my face was plastered everywhere. I did have like sort of a veil covering my nose and mouth, the same areas yeah. that the mask covered.
Wow.
And then they had attached another sort of sheer-ish kind of veil that hung over like my forehead, eyes, wow. my full face.
So you were covered.
And I remember sitting in the bus depot before the bus left and just, I mean, staring at a woman, just thinking like, notice something.
God.
And I must have annoyed her or scared her or irked her or something, because finally she just looked at me and she snapped at me like, what are you staring at? Why don't you take that rag off your face? And at that point I was just like, oh my gosh, like no one's going to help me anyway.
Wow.
And so that is...
So how many months were you in those hills behind your home before?
So I was kidnapped in very early June, and we did not leave Salt Lake until like the very beginning of October.
Wow.
Yeah. And so then he took me to Southern California, and we were there until the end of February. And that's when I was able to convince them that we should return back to Salt Lake, and that the best way to do that would be by hitchhiking. Because in my mind, I was like, okay, this is going to put me in contact with people. We'll be in like a very close proximity. Like, surely whoever picks up hitchhikers on the side of the road is going to like be asking some questions, because I would think their personal safety comes to mind before they pick up someone. So certainly, like, someone's going to notice something. So that was my idea, which looking back,
you were able to get them to manipulate them in a way to get them to do that.
Yes.
Which is extraordinary.
Well, they set the example. Like, they set the model for that, because when they'd say things like, oh, you know, like, I just feel inspired to tell you that God commands you to go naked all day tomorrow. And you need to follow this, because you need to realize, like, you are no better than anyone else. And we need to start at the beginning, and we need to be like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. So you need to go naked all day tomorrow. Like, they use like this kind of like religion, or like this God says, to manipulate
all of their commands,
everything
and their views.
So I decided I could try to use the same formula, if you will. And I mean, when I approached him, I said, you know, I feel like we're supposed to go back to Salt Lake. Like, I know God would never like speak to me, but could you ask him? Because like, I know he'll tell you. And that's how it was decided. Wow. We'd come back to Salt Lake. And then they were talking about how we'd get back. And I said, I think I need to experience hitchhiking, because, you know, both of you have suffered so much, and you've experienced so much in your time and in your travels as you've walked on foot, as you've, you know, you've done plane, trains, cars, you know, you tugged your own house behind you, like pulled it with your own hands and stuff. I was like, and you hitchhiked as well. You had to rely on like the generosity of other people. Like, I feel like that's probably, important for me to experience, because I know I'm not supposed to talk about my life prior to being rescued, but like, I never had to walk anywhere. Like, okay, I walked to the school bus stop for the school bus to come pick me up, and that was it. Mm-hmm. But like, my mom picked me up, she dropped me off between me and my brothers and my sister. I mean, I'm sure my mom felt like she never left her car. but that ultimately worked in hitchhiking.
So you camped again in California?
We were outside, yeah.
So they just found a remote location and off the grid.
Yep.
And you were there for some more months, and then you convinced them into coming back to Utah.
Yep. And yeah, it was the end of February, and then it took us like 12 days to get back, and I was rescued on March 12th. So we started back on the 1st of March. We made it back to Utah on the 12th of March.
And you hitchhiked the whole way.
And we hitchhiked the whole way.
Did anyone ask? You said, you know, you were hoping that someone would recognize you.
I didn't know it at the time. But, I mean, years later, when my case was finally coming to trial, and I had the opportunity to speak with the FBI agents who were investigating it, I mean, they really did a very thorough job in tracking down probably almost all, if not all, almost everyone who picked us up. And like, had the chance to speak with them. And I guess there were multiple people who were like, something is going on here. Something's not right. And they had then called up their local police and reported it.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
And you just celebrated 2 decades, right? Of your rescue.
Yeah. It's been 20 years. About 2 months ago now.
Do you remember that day? Like,
yes.
It was yesterday.
I mean, like, on one hand, I can remember it very well. On the other hand, it feels like a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah,
that morning. Is there anything about that that you want to share about that experience of being rescued?
I mean, I think just like it was honestly my rescue. It was a miracle. It's a miracle that like I was still alive because you know, most people that are kidnapped, most people that disappear, like if they're not found in the first 48 hours, they never come back alive. So, I mean, it is a miracle that like I'm still alive. And you know, that day when someone called the police, reported it to the police came and showed up and started questioning. And I didn't immediately respond with, yeah, I'm Elizabeth Smart. Please, please save me. I mean, it's also, I mean, it's like the same as why I didn't speak out on the bus. It's not because I didn't want to. It's because I felt the responsibility to stay alive. I felt the responsibility to keep my family safe. And also, like, I didn't know the police. I'd never had any interaction with the police prior to my kidnapping, you know? Like, and all I could think of is, why is a police officer going to believe a teenager
over
these two adults who are claiming to be, like, God's ministers on earth? Like, wow. Why would they believe me? And what will happen to me if I say I'm Elizabeth Smart and the police officer doesn't believe me?
Because you had, in a sense, gained their trust enough to pretend like you were going along with it to keep yourself alive.
Well, and, you know, like initially as they're questioning me, like I had a captor standing on either side of me so close that they were both physically touching me. I mean,
yeah, what are you gonna,
like, I just wasn't able to be like, yeah, I'm Elizabeth, like, come rescue me. Like, this guy could just pull his knife out and, like, cut my throat right now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it, like, it was scary. And when I was rescued, or when the police finally separated me from my captors and put me in the police car, I mean, they did initially handcuff me, which then made me think I shouldn't have said anything.
Wow.
Like, I was wrong. And then, you know, I was brought to the police station and I thought, like, I was brought to this little room that it's probably not a holding cell, but it felt like a cell.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking I said the wrong thing. I should have just told him, like, I should not have admitted that I was Elizabeth Smart because now I'm going to jail.
Oh my God.
But then the door opened and my dad was there. And like when he was hugging me and he was just crying and crying and saying, you know, Elizabeth, is it really you? I mean, that was when, like, that was when I finally felt safe because I didn't know what was going to happen next. Like, I didn't know if I was in trouble or not, but I knew that my dad was there and he wasn't going to let anyone else hurt me the way that these two people had hurt me the last 9 months. And so that was kind of the beginning of the next chapter of my life.
Wow. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that in such detail. And I mean, I remember you said in the beginning that you're not taught what to do if someone were to break into your home or attempt to kidnap you in any place. And I was never taught what to do until the night that you were taken. And I remember very vividly, you know, I also grew up in Utah, in the same suburb as you and my parents. We were getting ready to leave on a camping trip. There was stuff all over the floor, and my parents sat us down, and me and my siblings were on the stairs, and they were standing there, and they said, a girl named Elizabeth Smart was taken, and this is what happened, and this is what you do. And I was like, she's my age, you know? And I remember so vividly just, like you said, we just grew up the same way and in the same culture, and you're never scared. You don't think anything could happen. And your story, you know, prompted our whole state, the whole nation, to be aware and begin to teach those safety steps. I saw your face everywhere. I prayed for you so many times. And it's actually crazy. A lot of people are wondering how we know each other. And actually it was, Ryan and I had watched your Lifetime documentary that you produced. When was that? What year was that? A few years ago.
I feel like it was feel like I was maybe pregnant during it. So it's either like 5 or 7 years ago.
Wow, already?
Yeah. I feel like I always get immortalized pregnant. I'm ready to leave that behind.
Girl, pregnancy was rough for me. I don't know about you, but no, I remember watching that with Ryan, and we both went to the same college. I mean, like, I feel like, you know, I like everyone else in the nation was aware of you. And I did feel like we had so many similarities. And then I watched this documentary and I thought, man, I wonder if she's on Instagram. Like, I'm just going to look her up and send her a message and just tell her that I love her. And that I just like cannot believe, you know, not just what you've survived, but the choices that you've made in the wake of that to help others. It's incredible because no one could ever blame you if you never wanted to speak of or think about that again, or if you never wanted to be in the public eye again. You know, there's so many other options. And I looked up on Instagram and you had actually messaged me. And when I found your account and I saw that you had reached out to me, it was like, oh, it's so crazy. And I messaged you back and it turned out that you were local near where I was. And so basically the next week I think you invited me up to your home and we ended up, I think we were going to go to lunch, but we ended up sitting at your house and talking for like 4 hours.
Yeah,
I think. And I was like, I love this human so, so much. But yeah, all that to say, I feel so in awe of what you've done with this new chapter of your life that you have entered. And there are two like main things to this podcast that I really want to ask you about. And the first of which is your foundation, which, I mean, who goes through something that horrific and then chooses, you know what, I'm going to do everything I can to protect others from this. And that's exactly what you did. And you started the Elizabeth Smart Foundation. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that journey, what you do with that, where that's at right now.
So my dad and I actually started the Elizabeth Smart Foundation. Geez, I guess it's been about 12 years ago now. And over the years, in the beginning, it was much more of a passive foundation. I mean, we connected people or donors to like needs within this world of anti-sexual exploitation. But then the last, I guess, right before COVID happened, right before the world shut down, I felt like it was time to really make it more active and not just be behind the scenes, but really try to, in a larger, I suppose, more public way, work to make a difference. And so initially I started a couple of different programs. One of them was our Smart Defense program, which is a trauma-informed self-defense program.
So cool.
Which like we have the most amazing director, like she's probably a head shorter than me. And honestly, like she could take me down with her pinky.
Just a force. Like, I love it.
Like you sit there and think like, oh, you could just like sit on her. No, there is no, like if she gets you on the ground, like your life is over. That you've got a better chance standing than you do on the ground.
I love it.
But no, it encompasses a lot of breath work because honestly, probably 3/4 of the women and girls that come through our program are survivors already.
Wow.
And so it's a lot of, you know, consent-based, trauma-informed. Like we do a lot of breath work in there. And honestly, like it's been so eye-opening because like, you know, she'll call attention beginning of class, like at the beginning or at the end of the class, she does like some meditation and like she like gives people things to think about as they go through the class. And at some point during the class, she'll usually ask like women to say one thing that they like about themselves, or
oh,
like
I
the participants
that.
To say one thing that they like about themselves. And she's like, you know, it's heartbreaking to see like
how hard it is
for these individuals to find even just one thing that they like about themselves. And so she's amazing. And actually it's so incredible because we were able to partner with Southern Utah University and help it become an accredited class being taught down there. So it's incredible. Super excited about that.
That's huge.
Yes. Now we just have to work on all the other universities.
Yeah, come
in the
on,
world.
You guys. We're gonna push. We're gonna.
Yeah. So that's one of our programs that Elizabeth Smart Foundation started, and then we had another one that is really, I mean, it's like, it's, I'm not saying it's my favorite, but it's my favorite. Like, it's so important to me because I think of where I am today and I have so many people asking me like, well, how are you functioning? Or you seem so normal. Like, they're so surprised.
Yeah.
You seem so normal. Like, what did you do? Or like, what therapy did you do? Or, you know, what would you recommend for healing? And, I mean, there's a lot of great therapy yeah. out there.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Like, I support going to therapy. I support getting the help you need. Absolutely. But I think maybe the first and foremost important thing that you can do right off the bat is to believe a survivor. And I feel like because I had that belief right from the get-go, like my family never doubted me, my community never doubted me. I mean, there's like
yeah.
the crazies that you meet everywhere that have been like, you're lying or whatever, but
it's unfathomable to me.
I mean, yeah, it's crazy, but the vast, vast majority of people have always believed me. And I think that's made such a difference for me. That's made me feel like I can move on.
Wow.
Because I had that belief. I don't feel like people think I'm a liar or that I'm just making things up or that I'm just attention seeking.
Do you feel like that belief that those around you had in you, instilled in you, or allowed you to have that belief in yourself?
Yes. And so that is how we started our We Believe You campaign, and we run it all November. I mean, it's like it's year round, but we draw special attention to it through the entire month of November.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, it's like it's multiple fold, but it's number one to let survivors know that there's a community for them,
yeah.
that we do believe them, that we, you know, there's a safe place for them to land.
Like, wow.
It's okay. We believe them, but it's also to provide education to the communities because, you know, sexual assault is so shocking when you hear about it. It's almost like you don't know how to respond.
Yeah.
What do you say? And, yeah. and like, how do you help them move forward? And so providing education, because unfortunately, like statistically, like whether you consciously know someone who's like open about their abuse or not, like you do know someone who's been sexually assaulted. You do yeah. know someone who's been abused, just because it like statistically it's so high. Yeah. So it's to give a community to survivors, and it's also to provide education for our community.
And awareness.
So those were the two sort of main focuses of the Elizabeth Smart Foundation. And then coming up on a year and a half ago, we actually merged with another local foundation here in Utah called the Maloof Foundation.
Yes.
And their views and our views just aligned. Honestly,
beautiful.
It was one of the best decisions that I have ever made because on one hand, like, you know, I did not study nonprofit.
Yeah, yeah.
I did not study business administration. Like I don't know those things.
Yeah. You bring the drive and passion, but you need a team.
And so joining with them where their like vision and their goals were the same as ours, but they provide like the machine behind
yes.
it so that I can focus on what's important to me.
Yeah.
Has made such a difference. And now that we are together, you know, we also have the On Watch program, which if you want a free way to be involved, you want a free way to like learn more to make a difference, go to iamonwatch.org, take the free training.
iamonwatch.org.
It's recognizing signs of human trafficking.
We're going to put that in the notes of this podcast just so you guys listening, you can look that up.
And and then our other program that we have that is also like really really amazing and exciting. There's two. One of them is called Rooms Restored, and they go into rooms where, well, if a child has been sexually assaulted, sexually abused, we are able to go into their bedrooms and they get to choose, like they get to redecorate it.
Oh.
And you think like of where so much trauma happens in bedrooms, like not only to go in there and completely change it, but also allow them to make choices, because probably I would guess over 90% of perpetrators who sexually assault children, they wouldn't say it's about the act of sex. They'd say it's about the act of power, like total control. Domination over another person. So to be able to give that child back some power is huge.
Yeah.
So that's our Room Restored program. And then this other program, which is so amazing. Every year we do an educational summit, and we actually just had our summit last week.
I missed it.
It's okay. How did it go? Have another one next year. It was great. Yeah. Good. There was a lot of really just inspiring, motivational people. And like the sharing of ideas is incredible. And at our first summit, it just so happened that there were two individuals seated together at the right place at the right time. One of them was the dean of SUU, Southern Utah University. And the other one, I'm going to butcher what his exact position is, but he like managed a lot of clients' money.
Okay.
And they were sitting there together talking like, what can we do? What can we do? And they came up with the idea that they were going to help us as a foundation create a scholarship program for survivors of sexual abuse to be able to apply for and have their education, they get their bachelor's degree in general studies online paid for through the scholarship fund. It's called the Juniper Scholarship.
Oh, that gave me chills. That's incredible.
So those are some of our main focuses. But all of our programs, all of our focuses are based on education, healing, and advocacy.
Education, healing, and advocacy. Mm-hmm. That is so beautiful.
Yeah.
You said, you know, one of your biggest the biggest reason that you joined with this other foundation was that you could focus on what you were passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
What pieces are you passionate about?
I feel like everything I've just talked about is...
Yeah, I can feel it. I can see it.
I've just met too many people where they've been abused. They've never had the support. They've never had help. They've struggled. And I feel like so many other issues that we are combating, if you trace them backwards, I feel like a lot of the root cause comes from childhood sexual abuse. I'm not saying everything, but I do feel like there is a pretty large correlation. And I just, it breaks my heart. And then when I think statistically, unfortunately, the rest of America is about 1 in 4. Utah is 1 in 3 girls.
Wow.
And I have 2 daughters myself. And, you know, every day I'm just okay, well, in my household, you know, there's me, there's my 2 daughters. Please let me be the one for the 1 in 3. Don't let anything happen to my girls.
Ugh.
So, I have my boundaries, of how much I can do in a day, but I don't think I can stop because I look at my little girls and my son for that matter and think please, don't let anything ever happen to them.
I think every parent can resonate with that. Amazing. And speaking of, I think you just recently launched a new program,
yes,
which is one of the things that I said we must talk about here during this episode. And it is your Wholehearted Consent program, all about sexual consent, what that actually means, what that can tangibly look like. Tell us everything about this.
So my Whole Heart Consent class, it is separate from my foundation, but I do feel like it still supports same goals of education, healing, and advocacy. It did come about because a number of years ago, I was interviewing these 3 women, and 2 of the women, they were smart, they were intelligent, they were accomplished, beautiful women. They shared their experiences with me of how ultimately they'd been raped, but how they hadn't realized what had happened to them was rape until a lot of time later. And in that moment, I just remember feeling like my mind was blown, because how are we not doing a good enough job of teaching our world what sexual violence is or what rape is, for them to be all the way in college and not know what it is. So ever since then, I've just felt like it's like my mission to do something about it. And as the years have gone on, I mean, there's just too many stories where women are like, I didn't think I could be raped if I was married. Or if it was my boyfriend, or I mean, vice versa. Yeah. I mean, it's not just women, but whoever. Like, I didn't think it could happen to me, and like, part of me is just like this isn't okay. Like, yeah. Your body is a gift. Like, nobody has the right to touch it, and so the wholehearted consent. Like, I'll be the first to admit, like, I am not an expert. Like, I haven't studied this. I don't have a degree. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I don't have a degree next to it. But I feel like I am an expert on having my consent taken away from me and having my consent violated. And that's really the perspective that this class is taught from.
Yeah.
And, you know, consent, it is in this course, it is based more around sexual intimacy, consent in and around intimacy. But consent, I mean, honestly, it factors into every part of our life. And consent is, you know, when you decide to engage in intimacy with another person, it should be wholehearted consent. I remember I did a podcast years ago with Lewis Howes. He has his podcast, School of Greatness. And it was right after my memoir was published. And he asked me, well, how is a person supposed to know if You're trying to tell me that no means no, that even yes means no sometimes. How is a person supposed to know when yes actually means yes? And I was like, well, how is it consent if, you know, like a trafficker is forcing a young girl to go in and have sex with you, even though she's saying yes? Does that mean it's really yes? Like, no, it's not. And I mean, like, full credit to him, I think he does understand that because he is a survivor himself. But consent, it shouldn't just be verbally given. I mean, you know, your heart, your body, your mind, they all have to align for it to be wholehearted. And it should be ongoing. And it's something that can be retracted at any point in time. I mean, like, for example, maybe this is too much information.
No such thing here.
Like, my husband, he's always like, is that good? Do you like that? Is it good? And I don't like, sometimes I'm like, just finish the job. Like, it's fine. I'm like, yes, it's great. But like, he's always like very aware and conscious of me. And like, he's like, well, I don't want to do something if it hurts you. That's not sexy. He's like, it's only sex. Like, if you're excited and if you're in it, he's like, that's what like gets me excited and me into it. I know.
I love it.
A lot of information. But I mean, did you know, like, if we did a better job on educating on consent, that we could reduce sexual abuse potentially up to 90%.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Crazy, isn't it? Where you think, wow, like here in the state of Utah, let's just talk about that for a second. One in three girls in the state of Utah. Like, and we could reduce that by 90%.
By focusing on preventative.
I mean, nationwide, awareness. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys. Like, we could reduce that 90%. That is a huge number, which, like, that's, you know, that's such a big part of why I wanted to create this wholehearted consent. I mean, like, life should be beautiful. Yeah. Life should be wonderful. Like, having meaningful relationships is important. And sex is a big part of that. So you take that into consideration and then you think, wow, we could reduce sexual abuse by 90% if we did a better job on educating.
It seems just like such an obvious.
What consent is.
If people actually understood, like, that, I feel like, how could everything not change in order to make that
exactly.
happen?
Exactly. So it's, I'm really...
So with this wholehearted consent program, it's a course. Yeah. Tell me about like the logistics. Like, how long is this? Who should be taking this?
Everyone should be taking this. And I mean, you can go to wholeheartedconsent.com or just click the link in my Instagram bio and it'll take you there. And it's a series of videos. But I mean, like, yes, you could just click through and watch the videos, but like, I urge you not just to like click through them really quickly. Like, I urge you to take the time to think about the topic at hand. And I mean, like, I suggest tasks, and it's about figuring out what your boundaries are. And even though you maybe haven't experienced something yet, you can still figure out what you feel okay with. I mean, I think like, there's enough sexual content on social media, in movies, that you can kind of get a sense of, you know, what would you be comfortable with? And, you know, in life, nothing is written in stone. Like, what you're okay with can change and evolve over time.
Absolutely.
One definition or one set of boundaries, that's better said, one set of boundaries doesn't have to last you till you're cold
it's like
in the grave.
Who and how and where are you right now? And what do those boundaries look like right now? And then in a loving relationship, that will often ebb and flow and shift.
Exactly. So, I mean, it is videos. You can sit and watch them. But I would also highly recommend taking the time to do the suggested worksheets, like the suggested, like ask yourself those questions and figure out where you are and what works for you and you know, really put time and thought into it.
Wow. So this is available online to anyone.
Yes. Yes.
What's the cost?
Today, not just today, but I have a promo code and it's 20 years, 20YEARS.
Wow.
And the promo code will take $49 off. So
Elizabeth, amazing.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for offering that to us. That promo code will also be published in the notes description of this podcast, wherever you're listening. And how long will that be good for?
I don't know.
Okay, well,
a while.
Give it a while. Yeah, maybe they're listening in 10 years to this episode. Who knows? And
go ahead and give it a try.
Yeah, but that's gonna be there for you, as well as the website that you can go to. And again, remember that this is for everyone, not just for survivors, not just for women. This is important, so important, way more important than I realized, to raise awareness surrounding consent and what that means and what that looks like, so that we can change that statistic dramatically.
I mean, and I would argue it's equally as important for boys, because if we're not educating boys, then...
Oh, absolutely.
Like, how are we... How do we expect
to change? I would venture
to
say it's almost more important.
I mean, there should be respect on both sides.
Absolutely.
And, like, boys are vulnerable, and they should be able to have their boundaries be respected as well.
100%.
As well as any person, any human. I'll say that.
Yeah.
This is good for any human.
Yes. And it's necessary. And thank you. Thank you for creating this and for giving us this promo code as well. I love it. You've been doing so much good, working so hard. I'm so proud of you. We do have some questions. Well, we had a lot of questions, but I combed through and I kind of culled it down, picking one more poignant question kind of per topic that arose. Do you want to move through some of those now?
Okay,
yeah, cool.
Let's do it.
First and foremost, I do have to say, and I know I told you this earlier, but the resounding response to this question box for you was not actually questions asked. It was love and support and thanks. People are in awe of you, and they share, you know, the sentiment that I expressed, that what you've done with what you've been through is such a beacon of hope and such a beautiful testament that first of all, you are not what you've been through, that your life equates to so much more than the things out of your control. Even the worst, unfathomable things can't and don't have to break you. And everyone needs that hope. And you have so selflessly chosen to do these things that we've been talking about and bring that hope to the world. So on behalf of everyone that poured in, thank you again.
But thank you.
Okay, so these are obviously going to be pretty heavy, as given the subject of what we're talking about. But there is no one more qualified to speak on these things. So How can I best support a loved one who has suffered abuse?
Start by believing them. By loving them. And it's, it's a scary topic. It's a heavy topic. It can feel overwhelming. I'm not saying you have to like sacrifice your life 100%, but don't disappear. Wow. Don't disappear out of their life. It's so it's good to have boundaries, as we just discussed.
Yeah.
Like boundaries are healthy, but don't disappear.
That's a really, really good insight. So this question is very similar, but I don't know if you have any more thoughts. How to best help a friend who has gone through an abusive, traumatic relationship?
I would mostly say the same thing. First of all, believe them, support them, don't disappear. And it's, I mean, like someone very close to me right now is not in a healthy relationship. I just got out of a bad relationship and jumped into another one. And you can't, unfortunately, as much as I wish I could, you can't force anyone to do something that they're not ready to do yet. And so continue to love them and then be there for them when they're ready.
Yeah. Wow. How do you find forgiveness and the ability to move on and leave the hurt behind you?
Growing up, I used to think like forgiveness was like someone hurt you and you go back to them. You're like, it's okay. And then like, you know, you become friends and like you let go of the past and, you know, very kind of like school playground kind of thought. But as I've gotten older, maybe I've just gotten more selfish because I don't feel like forgiveness has anything to do with another person. Forgiveness is self-love. I think it's loving yourself enough to let go of the past.
Wow.
To not carry around all of the extra weight of sadness and anger and pain. Like, for example, I feel like I have moved on in my life. I feel like I have forgiven my captors. I never want to see them. I never want to have anything to do with them. I don't want to see a picture of them. I don't want to talk to them, but I've let it go. Like it doesn't haunt me.
Wow.
Every day. Like I can go live my life happily and it doesn't bother me. But like, I feel like if I had been, you know, if I was still holding on to that anger, if I was still holding on to that resentment, that would stop me from being happy. That would stop me from, you know, being the best mom that I can be. And honestly, like, I'm not a perfect mom already. Like,
no one is.
Like, there's definite room for improvement for me. But to think, like, on top of, like, my best efforts, if I was still carrying, like, anger and resentment around, that would hold me back even farther.
Forgiveness is self-love. Yes. That is so powerful. I love that. How did you or can I reclaim your body, my body, after everything you endured?
I honestly feel like you might even be better to answer this question than me, but I'll give it a shot. To begin with, your body did nothing wrong. Like, no matter what you were wearing or what happened, your body didn't do anything wrong. I had a woman reach out to me a while ago and said, I have struggled with severe, like crippling guilt because while I was being raped, my body orgasmed.
Oh.
And I just wanted to hug her and tell her, would you be embarrassed if you went to the doctor and he had like his little hammer and he like knocked on your knee and your leg kicked?
Yeah.
Like it's a reaction.
Yeah.
Like, and like your body didn't do anything wrong.
Wow.
And I feel like you do need to build a relationship with your body and realize that your body didn't betray you. And if anything, like for all the hurt that you've been through, for all the pain that you've been through, and whether or not you feel like your body has been the source of that pain or not, like you are more than your body. And in my mind, your body is honestly your first line of defense. Like your soul resides in your body and no one can hurt your body. There's like this line from Jane Eyre that I love, and I won't quote it perfectly, but it's a point in the book where like Mr. Rochester's talking to Jane and he's all impassioned and he's like, you know, like I could ruin the cage that the bird sits in, but even if I ruined the cage, like the bird would escape. Oh. And I feel like that, I mean, he was using that as an example of he could like kill her with his hands, but he'd still never get at her soul.
Wow.
And I feel like that applies to this situation as well. Like your body, like our bodies are gifts.
Yeah.
And it is your first line of defense. And nobody has the right to hurt your body. Nobody has the right to hurt you. And if that has happened, like I'm deeply sorry. You did not deserve it. It is not your fault. But don't hate your body over what's happened. It's only trying to protect you.
Wow, that's so beautiful. I agree with, I think you are the perfect person. So I think you answered that so beautifully. And I just think that's so true. Our body is, you know, our soul's home. It's our best friend, whether or not we recognize that or treat it that way. And especially if you've ever been victimized to any degree, it's not your body's fault and it's not your fault. And your body, it's not necessarily that it needs to be reclaimed, because it never can be anyone else's, no matter what they've said or done.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. So this is a big one. What are ways that we can protect our children?
The best piece of advice I've been given, and I wish I came up with it, but I didn't, is that when your kids start asking questions, that is the right time to start talking about it. That's scary. My kids have asked me questions that I've like frozen in panic and been like, I'm not ready to talk about this yet.
Yeah.
But if you don't take the time to talk with them, they'll turn to Google or they'll turn to their friends and then you're completely out of the conversation. So speaking with your children often and when they're young throughout their entire life is so important. And then, you know, I've attended different parenting conferences and I've listened to a lot of experts speak about it, and I appreciate it. Like people come to me and ask me questions and I'm always like, I'm not an expert. I've only been a mom for 8 years. Like,
but it's, you know, your heart and your experience.
I'm still trying to figure it out, but I've appreciated what other people have said. And they say, you know, when your child does something that you're not happy about and you have this big reaction, and it's in the grand scheme of things, like a fairly small thing. Like if you spent all day cleaning and then your kids come home and like, I don't know, like pour syrup on the floor or like smear chocolate on the carpet or, oh, I hate slime. Like I hate slime. Slime is not allowed in our house. And we have white carpet, which it's beautiful, but it's not a parent's friend.
Yeah, not the most practical.
My kids dropped blue slime on it and it got left there and I didn't know about it.
Yeah, we've been down that road with green slime.
Yeah, and like I had to like go and like scrape it up like with my fingernails and I was like scrubbing
the ice cubes. Yeah.
Like I feel like I just ended up ripping out like half of like the fibers in the carpet. But like I was rather angry about that because I've told them and told them and told them, no slime. Do not bring slime home. If you're going to bring slime home, just leave it in the kitchen or leave it outside. Do not take it to your bedroom. Of course, they take it to their bedroom. Mm-hmm. So I was very upset about that. But then if you think, and like as I'm saying this, just everyone keep in mind, like, I'm not perfect at this. Like, I'm a work in progress.
No one is perfect.
But these parenting experts that I listened to, they made this great point that if you have these big reactions to ultimately what are fairly small things happening, kids then silence the big things because they're worried about how you're going to respond, which is honestly not their responsibility. And so a lot of parents have, or a lot of these experts have talked about having like the bubble of trust or the cone of silence, where it's like your child can come to you where you've spoken about it a lot with them beforehand. So it's like, if anything bad ever happens and you're scared of how I'm going to react, you come to me and you say, you know, I'm enacting the bubble of safety or trust or whatever.
Why is this making me so emotional right now?
Like, you can tell me anything you want. I promise I won't yell. I promise I won't be angry. And, you know, I will listen to you and there'll be 24 hours before we talk about it again.
Wow.
And that gives the child enough time to like decompress from the stress of sharing it with you. And that gives you time to cool down your emotions.
Wow.
Think about it in a more like rational manner. And then
I'm
come back
teach
to them
today, like today,
come back to them and talk to them. I mean, maybe there are natural consequences. I mean, maybe there are consequences that need to happen. Maybe your child did something where it's a behavior or something needs to be addressed, but you'll take that 24 hours without having a major explosion of reaction where you can calm down and think about it and discuss it before you come back to your child and continue the conversation.
And deliver, you know, whatever consequences or not with love and with a level head instead of out of
anger. I'm like, yes.
You can act instead of react.
I need to do that.
Which is something we talk about here sometimes.
Yes.
The power in that. That was beautiful. I needed to hear that. Setting boundaries. I know we've talked about the importance of boundaries, but do you have any tangible tips? Like if someone is in a relationship, whether it be marriage or, you know, any sort of relationship, whether it be a friendship or even like parent-child relationships, are there tips for setting boundaries that kind of are just sweeping, like this is how you can set healthy boundaries, or this is, you know, or would you just say take this course?
I mean, I would say take this course.
Yeah.
Like use it. It's a great tool. I mean, I'd also say like through this whole journey that I've been on about learning more about wholehearted consent, learning more about boundaries, you know, I think being like as upfront and open about it as possible is going to help you in the long term. I mean, it gets a little bit more difficult the closer people are to you. I mean, like if it's like a parent and that's crossing boundaries, I mean, that can be a little bit more intimidating.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I get it. Believe me. But like sticking to your boundaries, like reinforcing your boundaries, not just letting people steamroll over them. And if they do, then that person maybe does not deserve your time. Or maybe there needs to be a little bit more distance in between you. Like, I'd also say trust your gut. Like,
yeah, that's like, very powerful.
Like, if something feels off, like, whether you can see it or not, like, trust yourself.
Yeah, I love that. So acceptance of differences of any kind. So like your life path, how it differs from the norm, or like your life path differing from your family's or your parents.
I think it's kind of like we were talking right before we even turned on the mic, before we started recording, like there is no such thing as normal.
Nope.
Everybody has a story. Everybody's family has like their problems, their issues. Normal is a fairy tale. Normal is not real. And like for me, like, yeah, I have thought of what my life would have been like had I not been kidnapped. And yeah, there are things that would be like vastly different, but I think there were also things that would be the same either way. And, you know, ultimately, like I've kind of looked at what I envisioned my life to be had I not been kidnapped versus what it is. And honestly, like, I'm grateful for what it is, because maybe I wouldn't have the husband that I have. Maybe I wouldn't have the kids that I have. Like, it's given me a purpose and a passion that honestly, I wouldn't have otherwise. I mean, I think I would care, but I'd also be like, oh, thank goodness someone else is dealing with that. That's a big, heavy topic. I don't really want to go there.
Yeah. Wow.
And so, like, I don't regret where I'm at or how different my life is now from what I thought it would be.
Yeah. What an incredible perspective. One thing I often say is like, I believe that perspective is the most formative force in your life, because obviously there's many things that we don't get to control. You know that more than anyone. And your perspective of how you came out of that and how you put one foot in front of the other and to how you look at it right now and all that you just explained is extraordinary. And it has you, through your chosen perspective, have shaped the most beautiful life for yourself, your husband, your kids. And that's that's you, you know, like you've taken something that is so horrific and made the most beautiful life for yourself. And it's extraordinary.
Thank you.
And yeah, there's no such thing as normal for sure. We need to let go. We need to let go of all of those pressures, you know, to look or I think people panic trying to make their life, make sure that they're perceived in a certain light for their family or in a certain light. And the sooner we realize that what people think of us is not our business, it does not matter. I think the freer that you are. How do you control your worry for your kids after what you went through?
Yes, that is a struggle.
Yeah.
That is a struggle. I'm a work in progress. I feel like having a partner to help balance you is great. And my husband certainly does that for me. I also try to practice what I preach. I mean, I do try to speak with my kids a lot. I try to have I try to have good conversations about safety, about what's okay, what's not okay. They can come talk to me about anything. Yeah. Like, I feel like I always need to know where they are, who they're with. Are they with safe people? What makes a safe person? Yeah. Like, how well do we actually know them?
Yeah.
These are all things that I feel like I think about regularly a lot.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do try really hard to educate them, and trust them that they understand what I say. But first and foremost, I mean, the most important thing that I want them to know of all of this, of everything that I've spoken about today, I mean, I feel like everything I've spoken about is really important, but the most important thing that I want my kids to know is that I love them unconditionally. And if they know that I love them unconditionally, and then we've spoken about these safety precautions, we've had these conversations, we have them frequently. I feel like that's how I do my best at trying to manage my stress when it comes to my kids' safety.
That's beautiful. I think that is the best way to handle that, 100%. How do we foster resiliency in ourselves and the lives of young people?
I think first of all, like, we are all so much stronger than we think we are. When we hear other people's stories,
amen.
Like, I think we sit there and think, I could never go through that. I could never do that. But I think actually, like, if we actually looked at, like, trading people's trauma, trading your trauma for someone else's trauma, I think you'd probably choose your own trauma.
Interesting.
I think you probably wouldn't be like, no, I don't want that. I mean, I think you'd rather stick with what you've already experienced. Like, I think we are all so much stronger than what we think we are. And I mean, believe in yourself, like, build that relationship with yourself. Like, you are strong. Like, there is nothing like more resilient than the human spirit. And if you were alive, you have a human spirit inside you. Like, you were born strong. Like, weakness does not exist in this world.
Wow. That just gave me chills. That's amen to all of that. This one I thought was interesting. How to navigate the wake of trauma or abuse when none of your close people understand?
You need to find your family. I mean, your family, like, your biological family, like, hopefully they're not the ones that abused you. Unfortunately, just being realistic, like, most abuse that happens, it's probably from your family or from someone that you know or trust. It's probably from that community that doesn't understand it. But hopefully it's not. But like, because so much abuse does come from the people who are supposed to be protecting you, I find myself more and more saying, find your own family. Like, find those people who do understand you. Find those people who are there for you. Like, find your family. Having support, having people understand where you're coming from. And with the caveat of understanding that no one's ever going to understand 100%.
Yeah.
Like, no one else is you. Only you are. Only you know how you feel. But people who can
hold space
for you, have empathy for you, have compassion for you, find those people.
Yeah. And your foundation is there.
Yes.
If anyone needs to find that safe space. This one, we kind of touched on this, I think, but how do you cope with the speculation and judgment from those who don't know you? And I could tell that when you were sharing your story in the beginning, you've had your fair share of that, especially in regards to those two things, which infuriates me, honestly, like as an outsider. It's like, how dare someone presume that they know what they would do in your shoes? But I mean, it's a very good question and one that...
I mean, yeah. Yes, I have dealt with a lot of that. And I mean, honestly, like I'm trying to think of how to word this. Are there words that align with how I feel?
Take your time.
I'm not 100% sure, but I'll give it a shot. I just feel like there will be people in life that judge you for better or for worse, regardless of who you are, of what your story is, of where you come from, of what you look like, and the phrase, you can't please everyone is so true. Like, you cannot.
I know that.
You cannot please everyone, and you will be judged regardless. And I think we can all work a little bit harder to try to be a little bit more understanding and a little bit more compassionate, and realizing that, you know, when people like make their judgments or make up their minds on something, like, they probably aren't even aware of all the facts. Like, yeah, of these people who have decided something about me one way or the other, have they walked a mile in my shoes?
Yeah.
Have they lived my life? Do they actually know me? Would they actually say those kinds of things to my face?
Yeah.
And just kind of understanding that, like, people are people. Like, judgments, for good or bad, will be made. Yeah. And like, it's so hard. It's so hard not to. It's so hard not to like
those things
internalize and, it, yeah, or be affected. I mean, when I like see something mean or rude or some, like, I made a mistake, which I'm only human.
Which is crazy, because like, it's like, I've got to interject here. It drives me mad to see, I mean, Elizabeth and I, you know, we're friends. And just recently we were kind of venting to each other about some of the heat that we've both received online for various things. And to hear that you had experienced some like lashback for something, I mean, you guys, can we not? At what point do we not just have kindness and compassion and lift each other up? And it really was like, I had this profound moment because I know these things. I've talked about this a lot. But to hear you sharing what you shared with me and think, oh my God, or even her with the good, I mean, no one is doing this work. This work needs to be done. It is of paramount importance, what we were talking about today. No one is doing this. And here you are doing this in the wake of all that you've been through, and people have the sheer audacity to come at you for anything. I mean, it just really, I just saw it all so clearly. Ultimately, no matter what, you actually can't please everyone, and there will be judgment and hate, but here you are continuing anyway.
I mean, and I think you do just have to decide, like, I'm sorry you feel this way, but like, do their opinions actually matter?
No, they don't.
And like, I just think, you know, most of these people who are against me, there's probably two kinds. There's the kind of person that just doesn't know me, like, yeah, doesn't understand where I'm coming from or why I've made these decisions. Like, they're just not aware of all the facts. So it's not necessarily them just being terrible people or anything like that. Yeah. It's just, they're just not aware.
Yeah.
Or they are just terrible people. They are the predators. They are the perpetrators, living in their mom's basement, surrounded by their Star Wars figures, creeping on kids online.
Amen. Either way, we don't let it worry us. We are here. You are here continuing to do this work in the face of it. And that is, again, it's like you said earlier, you know, forgiveness is self-love. And I also think self-love is the biggest form of, I don't want to say the word revenge, but like, ultimately, what better thing can you do than to say to those who hurt you, you don't affect me anymore. You have no power over me. Here I am in my power, living my life, thriving, shining, helping others, despite. Like, that is, I don't know if there's such a thing as healthy revenge. I don't think that's classic revenge definition, but you know what I'm saying? Like, that's such a beautiful and powerful thing to be able to forgive for yourself and in yourself and move on and say, like, those people that tried to hurt me, they can't affect me anymore.
I'd agree with that wholeheartedly.
We have one more question.
Okay.
We can close on this one. And it's in the vein of hope, which I think, as I've said, you're such a beacon of. It says, how during those 9 months were you able to keep hope, and did you ever lose it?
I mean, there were some awfully dark days. I mean, there were some definite days that I questioned whether I would survive. I mean, whether I would live through it. So there were some very dark days, but going back to earlier when I talked about it's most important for me, for my kids to know that I loved them unconditionally, I feel like I was able to survive because I felt that from my parents. Oh. And I feel like if you know you're loved unconditionally, that is all the hope you need to do whatever you need to do.
Wow.
And that's how I felt.
That's beautiful. Oh, that is so beautiful. Well, thank you. I mean, thank you so much. I can't actually thank you enough for coming and sharing so openly and honestly. And I feel like there's so much here that people need to hear. So,
oh, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
And it's always wonderful to see you.
I know.
In person.
I know. We need to get together more often. I want to close with just giving you the opportunity to speak to anyone who has been victimized or who is maybe in that darkness right now or is currently experiencing abuse. Like, what message could you give?
There's three things I would want them to know. Number one, everyone has a story. You are not alone in experiencing abuse. You're not alone in experiencing rape. You're not alone in experience heartache and trauma. Everyone experiences something in their life. Everyone has a story. The second thing I would want you to know is that you were born with infinite worth, and nobody else can ever take that away from you. No matter what they do to you, nobody can take away your worth. And the final thing I would want you to know is, in a world of labels and political correctness is paramount to everything in this world, despite all of these things, the really truly amazing thing about life is that nobody else can define you. Only you can define you. And you do that through your actions, through your decisions, through your choices, what you decide to do moving forward. That is how you define yourself.
Wow. I have nothing to add. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You guys, thank you for listening. I always end these episodes and I just say I love you, because I just do love these people listening so much. And I love you, so thank you.
Well, I love you.
Thanks, guys.